Why?
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Okay, name this governor. She passed the largest tax increase in her state's history. She invested $600,000 in government funds on a state-owned dairy that went under. She appointed a state Supreme Court justice who supported abortion. She vetoed a bill that was anti-gay rights. The answer? Sarah Palin. Our guest Matthew Zenzi details all of this and more in his new book called Unlikely Liberal, Sarah Palin's Curious Record as Alaska's Governor. He lives now here in the Philadelphia area, but spent many years living in Alaska, and he also worked for the Anchorage Daily News. And Matthew Zenzi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here, Marty. Big fan of the show. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. And I have to say to our listeners, when Matthew emailed me with this book title, I wrote back and said, this is my least favorite topic, but nonetheless, you won me over because this is a Sarah Palin I think a lot of people in the lower 48 do not know.
Right, exactly. I remember coming back to my 30th reunion at Swarthmore College out in the suburbs here, Delaware County, and somebody heard that I was from Alaska, and they said, oh, Sarah Palin, you know, she's so terrible, she's, you know, conservative, etc. And I said, well, yeah, but did you know that she did all these liberal things when she was governor? And they looked at me like I had two heads. they just couldn't compute.
But does that tell us something about Alaska, Alaska politics, or perhaps the lower 48, or how we look at some of these national figures, or even Sarah Palin herself?
I think all of the above. It does speak to the disconnect between the lower 48 and Alaska, but it also is a curious phenomenon in politics that somebody who had one kind of record as a bipartisan, pragmatic, non-ideological, downplayed her social conservatism as governor, all of a sudden vaults onto the national stage, becomes a conservative, anti-government rock star, with a record that is so contradictory to the image she enjoyed on the national stage.
And one could call that reinvention. One could call that hypocrisy. One could call that lying. I mean, there's so many ways that we could describe, I guess, the transformation that she put herself through.
Well, I think the charitable interpretation is that Alaska is sui generis. You know, it's its own thing. It is the most socialist state in the union, as I explain in the book. And it is ironic that Palin would attack Obama as a socialist when she comes from governing the most socialist state in the union. I mean, they pay you to live there, basically. There's no income tax. There's no state sales tax. There's a cash payment from the earnings on the state's oil savings account. So it is a very different place. In her candidacy for vice president, she said, oh, Alaska's a microcosm. You know, of course I'm qualified. No, Alaska's not a microcosm of the United States.
But why is it, as you say, the most socialist state in the union? Is it just that it's so far away or it has all this oil money?
It's that it has all this oil money, and it's incredibly dependent on the federal government. The federal government's about a third of the economy with the money that it sends both to the state government and spends in-state on mostly on defense, huge defense presence there. Another third of the state is oil, basically, and the state has a very – most of the oil that's produced in state comes off state-owned land. So the state is the landowner that collects the royalties, and it also taxes, and it brings in – billions of dollars a year to support state government without a state income tax, without a state sales tax. As a matter of fact, one economist looked at it, I think it was 2006, that there were $13,000 of oil-funded services per person.
$13,000 per person.
Per person.
What's it like to live in Alaska, though? And you live there, what, 30 years?
Cold and dark in the winter and beautiful, you know, endless summer nights in the summer, wide open spaces, gorgeous country, interesting people, but long winters.
I can only imagine. I do want to ask just a couple of questions about her rise, I guess, to political power, to the governor's job in New Jersey, in Alaska. She took out Frank Murkowski.
Right.
You describe him as an arrogant bumbler.
Yes, incredibly out of touch. He was a U.S. senator for a long time, and it was probably a good thing he was away in Washington, so the Alaskans didn't see him up close, because when he came back to become governor, he became rapidly unpopular. He had sort of a CEO's arrogance about the perks of office. You know, he complained about how crappy the state's aircraft was for flying him around, and he wanted to get a state jet. And just very arrogant and wasn't doing what folks hoped he would do, which was jumpstart the $40 billion Alaska natural gas pipeline to the lower 48. And, you know, in his defense, he was presiding over a time when oil prices had sunk, and the budget was under a lot more stress than it would prove to be during Palin's term. So all those things combined to make him very unpopular. As a matter of fact, one of the people I quote in the book said it was Sarah Palin's great fortune to come behind Frank Murkowski because he was the worst governor in Alaska's history.
But she did run as a reformer, a legitimate reformer?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, she had a legitimate record on ethics, at least in a brand marketing sense. I mean, she had some controversies about ethics in her own record as governor or as mayor of Wasilla. She had campaigned for lieutenant governor on city time at the city office using city resources when she was mayor there. But somehow that just never really dented her image. She had spoken up in two ethical controversies that Governor Murkowski had, both times, going against the grain of her party and the party establishment, saying that, you know, these situations the governor was mishandling and really should have done better with. But one of the ethics cases was a case where the head of the Republican Party was working right next to her at the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, running a Republican business out of the state office on state time, and she busted him for it.
Whistleblower, right?
Yeah, but that's exactly what she did when she was mayor of Wasilla. I mean, there's so many contradictions in her record, it's mind-boggling.
Well, and just to underscore that, she signed, as governor, the largest tax increase in Alaska history.
Right, yeah. The previous oil tax that she inherited had been passed under a cloud of corruption. The FBI was doing an investigation, later indicted two lobbyists and several legislators for basically selling their votes, and the tax that passed was lower than many wanted, in part because the corrupt people were buying and selling votes. So she realized it needed to be readdressed, and in the process, they came up with a new system that really included escalators for very high oil prices, windfall profits, and oil prices took off. So the amount of money they started collecting went up by between 1.5 and 3 billion a year. Yeah.
I mean, would it be fair to say that she took on the oil industry in Alaska?
Absolutely. She was totally an insurgent. She was anti-oil. As a matter of fact, the big oil money in her governor's race went to the Democrat, who was an oil-friendly Democrat. She was seen as somebody who was not reliable enough on their issues and proved to be so because she passed the huge oil tax increase with the cooperation of the Democrats and the reformist Republicans in the legislature. And she also brought in a new approach to a competitive bidding approach to award incentives for natural gas pipeline development, which the big three oil companies, which also owned the gas, wanted no part of that. So, I have four chapters in the book saying Palin wins versus big oil, round one, round two, round three, round four. I mean, she really was a reformer who took on the oil industry.
But there is no pipeline yet, right?
There is no pipeline.
Just to sort of add a coda to that.
Right, yes. The state, under her leadership and advocacy, put $500 million on the table to pay most of the preliminary costs. And unfortunately, I think the shale gas boom that's taking place here is part of the reason that that project isn't getting much traction right now.
I mentioned in my intro, and this is really just quoting from your book, that she invested something like $600,000 in government funds on a state-owned dairy that eventually went under.
Right.
I don't know how many other states have a state-owned dairy, but she obviously tried to save it.
Right, yeah. It was in her home turf, her home county. We call them boroughs in Alaska, but it's a county. It's a legacy of the New Deal experiment in the 1930s when Franklin Delano Roosevelt helped move up what were called the Matanuska colonists to settle there and begin to start a dairy industry. So it was a socialist enterprise from the beginning.
And says with a funny look on his face, "Oh, go ahead."
Right. Yes. But long story short, the dairy never was viable as a standalone private business proposition, and the state had to take over ownership at one point and kept it for some 20 plus years. And then when the handwriting was on the wall, the administrators of the dairy said, we give up. It just isn't going to happen. And she made one last ditch run to try to keep it going. And I think in part because it was from her home area of the state. I mean, and there was nobody in the state saying, we're Tea Party types, get rid of every single shred of government, anything in the private sector. So she tried to save it. And, it didn't work.
How about on social issues? And we will then, you know, make the transfer to her national reputation. But looking at social issues in Alaska, where did she stand on things like abortion or gay rights or some of these, you know, sex education? I'm thinking of all the things that...
Well, what's interesting is it's pretty clear where she stood coming in as a gubernatorial candidate. And it's one reason that I and my colleagues at the Anchor's Daily News editorial page didn't endorse her, because she's very socially conservative. But much to our surprise, when she took office, she downplayed all those issues and really focused on gas line development, oil tax reform, ethics reform. And those were the big three. And, you know, to her credit, she didn't waste a lot of time, you know, fussing around with these, what she considered to be more tangential issues. We wrote editorials at the paper saying she probably disappointed her conservative base by not being more aggressive in pushing for abortion restrictions and trying to, you know, do things with gay rights, gay marriage, and the like.
So it was more like a hands-off that while she might have run on that, when it came to actually governing, it was, as you say, she was looking at other issues.
Right. She had much higher priorities, and in my own judgment as a commentator, I thought appropriately different priorities much higher.
Was she a popular governor, at least the very beginning of her career?
Oh, yeah, yeah. At one point, her popularity peaked out in the high 80s. There was one that had it at 90% approval rating. I mean, the only people who didn't like her were the Republican establishment and the oil industry. I mean, it's an incredible, incredible contradiction.
So taking what you just said and then, you know, moving ahead, obviously she's tapped by John McCain to be his vice presidential running mate. And we see this transformed Sarah Palin.
Right. Well, what's interesting is I saw her speech when the selection was announced. And I thought that was a lot closer to the Sarah Palin we'd seen as governor, because she talked about Hillary Clinton and, you know, 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling. And I thought, okay, maybe this will be a little different, because traditionally the nominee for vice president is the attack dog, goes after the other ticket, and then, you know, the presidential candidate can stay more on the high road. And I thought, well, this doesn't really fit, you know, the persona she established as governor, but maybe with that first speech, maybe this will be a little different. And then came the acceptance speech at the Republican convention, which was a full-throated, you know, pit bull with lipstick partisan attack on the Democrats and everything they stood for. And, you know, from there, she was off as a rock star, winning over people who apparently didn't know a whole lot about her record in Alaska.
And we're almost up on the break here, but were people in Alaska then scratching, literally or figuratively, scratching their heads saying, who is this Sarah Palin who was governor of our state?
I think we all were, because it was an incredible turnabout. It was 179-degree turn, and, you know, people like myself who hadn't voted for her but supported some of her initiatives were going, huh, what's with this? And, of course, the Republican establishment in the oil industry, which had opposed her, all of a sudden feel like, oh, we got to get with the team, you know, the Republicans, it's time to, you know, rally the troops behind the ticket. So it was quite a turnabout.
And that's Matthew Zenzi, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Unlikely Liberal. And yes, there's a picture of Sarah Palin on the cover of the book. It's subtitled Sarah Palin's Curious Record as Alaska's Governor. And our guest spent a number of years living in Alaska and was a journalist with the Anchorage Daily News. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments, give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Nezet-Sagan and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Ravel's La Valse and the Fifth Symphony of Shostakovich. Also, Leonidas Kavakos performs Shimanovsky's Second Violin Concerto. Tickets at philorg.org or by phone 215-893-1999. This Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, showpieces with Yannick Nezet-Sagan and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
During WHYY's last on-air campaign, members helped to buy back a half day from the drive. Wouldn't it be great to buy back a full day or more? For every 750 donations received by January 30th, we'll start the drive one day later. That's fewer pledge breaks and more news and information. Make your donation to support the WHYY buyback at whyy.org/support.
Amy Mann's music may cause you to shed a tear, but her life is filled with funny people.
Don't underestimate how insane comedians are. I mean, talk about dark and broken people. We vibe together very well at a lot of different levels.
That's singer, songwriter, and sometimes comedian, Amy Mann, joining us this week on Sound Opinions.
When you're a charmer, the apples fall.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Matthew Zenzi. He's the author of Unlikely Liberal, Sarah Palin's Curious Record as Alaska's Governor. He's a former Alaska journalist with the Anchorage Daily News, spent a number of years on their editorial board. He's also worked as an editor with the Philadelphia Inquirer and does an occasional piece for Huffington Post. And obviously joining us today on Radio Times talking about Sarah Palin then and now. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Matthew, it is interesting to hear you describe Sarah Palin in Alaska as governor, taking on the oil industry. And I remember, I think we all do so well, the drill, baby, drill that became part of the mantra of her and John McCain's campaign.
Right. Yeah. Well, in the Alaska context, there's not necessarily a contradiction there because Alaska wants lots of oil drilled so they can get lots of money for it so that the residents don't have to pay state income tax or state sales tax and can have a very large government without having to pay for it.
But you also quote her, and this goes back to September 2007, scientific evidence shows many areas of Alaska are experiencing a warming trend. Many experts predict that Alaska, along with our northern latitude neighbors, will continue to warm at a faster pace than any other state, and the warming will continue for decades going on from there, obviously raising some concern about climate change or global warming.
Right. It's just indisputable. In Alaska, you see the melting permafrost. You see much harsher storms raking the coastal villages. The fact that the Arctic is warming is indisputable. Now, what she does has come around to dispute is the cause of it.
Right.
But with the rhetoric that you just cited from the book, at the time, I thought maybe she's going to be reasonable on this issue. It turned out not to be the case once she became a national conservative anti-government star.
Well, did she do that and turn herself into what you just described because people didn't know her? The press wasn't covering her in a way that might illuminate another side of Sarah Palin, or that her followers were such true believers they didn't want to know about the other Sarah Palin?
I think more the latter, because as I was researching the book, I found a number of national stories that pointed out some of these contradictions. But as I learned from going to my 30th reunion at Swarthmore in 2009, apparently that coverage didn't penetrate very deeply, even among the relatively educated audience, you know, that a Swarthmore alumni crowd would be.
Does that tell us something, though, about not just her supporters, but just how people, the public voters, can glom onto someone and see what they want to see?
Absolutely. I think people looked at her and said, she's somebody just like me. You know, I trust her values. She knows what I want. And so, you know, I'm for her. And, oh, this other stuff? Well, I'll read you a comment or two from defenders of hers that have popped up over time as I've advanced this theme. Here's one who said, nothing she stated on the national stage contradicted anything she did as governor. Just the national media spun it like she did. I mean, this is cognitive dissonance for them. Her supporters can't really accept the reality that she had been a very different governor, mm-hmm. and so they either deny it or ignore it. Most of the kind of complaints that I've gotten as I hit this theme are basically just, you know, name-calling. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. you're the liberal media. Don't need to listen to you. We don't get to the level of facts and whether or not they matter.
One of the things that you write about, and I do remember reading about, was her, I guess, traveling with her children, mm-hmm. The use of some government funds. I guess this is when she was governor.
Right, yeah.
Use of government funds that allowed her to travel with her kids and maybe stay at really nice hotels.
Right, yeah. She faced an ethics complaint over that, and she settled it out of court with, the standard no admission to wrongdoing. In her defense, it was a challenge for her because she had a working husband. She was trying to telecommute from Wasilla, the first governor not to live full-time in the state capital of Juneau, which was 600 miles away, by air. And she had, lots of kids at home. So she's juggling a lot. And, first governor who had so many kids and had had all those arrangements. So it was a challenge for her, but she did settle by repaying about $10,000 of charges where she had taken her children, some of her children along on state trips. And you know, later the Associated Press even reported, and I saw in the email traffic that was released after the media organizations obtained her email records, you know, she's talking to her administrative assistant about changing some of the travel authorizations to show the kids as invited guests or a part of the official activities to increase the odds that, you know, it's a defensible use of state money to take the kids.
Because she did have this, I guess, private email network that she used from time to time.
Right, yes. And in the Troopergate investigation, both investigators said, you know, we're not sure we saw the relevant evidence because there was this private email network where, you know, partisan business, I mean, legitimately, you know, personal and partisan business probably shouldn't be done on a state email account. But then it was also clear from some backflow that you see in the emails that were released that, you know, there was a lot of state business stuff that was also being communicated through those channels. But that archive just kind of disappeared. It was never retrieved for the Troopergate investigation. And both investigators said, you know, we're not sure we saw everything that we needed to see because of that.
Well, you seem to say in the book that the Troopergate was not as bad as her critics said, and perhaps not as benign as her supporters said.
Well, it was one of those things where I think both sides were right because, you know, her ex-brother-in-law was a scuzzball who probably shouldn't be a trooper. I mean, he drank in the trooper car. He threatened to, you know, put an effing lead bullet in her father's head if he hired a lawyer to help the sister, you know, get divorced, and, you know, tased his son with the taser just so the kid could feel what it was like. You know, not trooper material. But, you know, she really grossly mishandled it by letting Todd, her husband, go all out trying to get him fired. And, you know, when the husband of the governor calls up, you don't just say, go away because it's not appropriate. You know, it has the imprimatur of the governor behind it.
Help us understand, I guess, their working relationship, because this book is not about some of the, you know, gossipy things about Sarah Palin, but as governor and even on the campaign trail, what their relationship was about. Then we'll get some callers in.
Well, Todd was her rock. I mean, she said as much in the speech that she wanted to give when she and McCain did not prevail on election night. And also, Todd took a leave of absence from his job on the North Slope. He's a blue-collar worker in the oil industry, not management. And for about the first 6 months, he basically set up shop in the governor's office and sat there. You know, people would say, well, I went in to see Sarah Palin. Whoa, Todd is sitting there at the desk. You know, he didn't say anything, but he'd set up shop in the governor's office. Now, eventually he went back to work, and he was on a week on or 2 week on, 2 week off type schedule, 1 week on, 1 week off. And so he wasn't there, you know, as much. But there was a point at which, you know, he was physically present. And also, there was an effort to get emails that Sarah Palin had communicated with Todd about state business, and the Palin administration resisted that, saying Todd Palin was a trusted advisor and it's protected by the deliberative process privilege under state law, and that is the interpretation that prevailed in state courts. He was a trusted advisor.
Is that unusual?
For a private citizen, I think so.
Just checking. Yeah. Just checking. I just want to understand Alaska. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in. Matthew Zenzi is our guest, and we're talking about his new book called Unlikely Liberal, Sarah Palin's Curious Record as Alaska's Governor. And he spent many years as a journalist with the Anchorage Daily News, many of those years as an editorial writer or a member of the editorial page board. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Roger from Newark, Delaware to join us. And Roger, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
I think Sarah Palin is somewhat of a metaphor for how people of my own political stripe, left of center, do a lousy job at connecting with people with traditional values on moral issues like she had, and so they wind up allied with the Tea Party, etc., because they're just treated as Neanderthals or something like that due to their social issue views.
To make sure we understand, Alex, Roger, it looks like you're saying that one of the reasons for Sarah Palin's rise is how badly the left treats people who might support a Sarah Palin?
Not so much her rise in 08 as her becoming a Tea Party heroine after the Tea Party was started in 2009 with the guy on CNBC's rant, etc., and the Tea Party sprung up after that. Although it started in the 2008 campaign where she was lionized by people who absolutely were corporatist types, oligarchs, whatever term you want to use for them.
Okay, fair enough. Roger, thanks for the call. Matthew, what do you think?
I think there's a fair amount of truth in that, and there's been a lot of discussion in progressive circles about why it has been more difficult for progressives to connect at kind of that emotional level with a base of support. Progressives are fighting the image of being these elitist intellectuals who, you know, only use their head, never use their heart, and, you know, can never make up their mind, and, you know, moral relativism and all those things. So I think your caller is on to something there, although, I would have to say that Sarah Palin's social values are clearly, out of the mainstream. She's against abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, which is, you know, way off the charts as far as the political support is concerned. That's a very minority point of view.
But I'm thinking, again, you know, just snatches of phrases out of that campaign, which seems a long time ago, I have to say, but the idea of then-candidate Barack Obama palling around with terrorists. I mean, clearly, he and Bill Ayers lived in the same neighborhood, but they weren't exactly pals.
Yeah, I think they showed up at a coffee at one point together early on in Obama's career. What's interesting, and I have a little section of it in the book, is that, you know, you could argue that Todd Palin or her husband was palling around with secessionists because he was a member of the Alaska Independence Party, and its platform is to reconsider the state's statehood status with the United States. I mean, and as Steve Schmidt pointed out, the campaign manager for McCain, the platform of the Alaska Independence Party is secession.
Let me get, looks like Alex from Allentown to join our conversation. And Alex, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
My question for Matthew is, do you think that Sarah Palin's shift in her political views is a result of her celebrity, or does she have a legitimate change of heart in what she really feels?
That's a good question, Alex. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. What do you think, Matthew?
Excellent question. I think it represents a confluence of a couple different factors. There's the celebrity element of it. You know, she realized that she could really advance her status by becoming the partisan pit bull with lipstick. She also, as I mentioned earlier in the show, is the governor of a very unusual state. So that to be a responsible governor of a state like that requires you to do some things that would not be transferable necessarily to, you know, governing the country as a whole. And I think another part of it is that she really does, as many politicians do, have this desire to be liked by everybody or as many people as possible. And she found that by presenting this sort of Alaska First agenda, that liberals and Democrats came along with her on that. I was like, this is cool. You know, people who probably didn't even vote for me are now supporting me. And so it really helped boost her popularity and sort of reinforced her psychologically. And then she had a chance to do things very differently and get much more adulation on the national stage. And so she just kind of pushed those things off to the side.
Well, nothing like applause and, you know, a good life.
Oh, absolutely. A lot easier life for her to be an occasional commentator on Fox and, you know, tweet on and post on Facebook and collect lots of money writing books. It's a lot easier work than, you know, making 120-some thousand as governor.
How do you see her intelligence, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, as I say in the book, she's not the dimmest politician I ever encountered in Alaska, and certainly not the smartest. She was able to talk about issues at one level deeper than sound bites. But when we had substantive discussions at the editorial board about her agenda as governor, particularly in the oil and gas area, which is a very technical area, she just punted to her technical team on those fronts.
Right. Meaning that either this was a little beyond her pay grade?
Well, just that not beyond her pay grade, perhaps beyond her enthusiasm for mastering that level of detail. Right. But she had a very capable team. I mean, her best staff was in the oil and gas area. It was amateur hour in most of the rest of her administration. The oil and gas team was very solid. I dealt with them a lot, have incredible respect for them and what they were trying to do and the quality of the work they did. And she was smart enough to let them have the ball and run with it and just, you know, be called in to make policy decisions when she had to.
You mentioned Steve Schmidt, and obviously had worked with her, and John McCain when they were on the campaign trail and came away very bitter and disillusioned with her, very angry at her, I would say, as well.
Yeah, she was pretty high maintenance. I mean, I really think she was starting to crack under the strain. It was such a huge jump up for her, especially, you know, given her circumstances as a relatively new mother with a special needs child, you know, completely unprepared for the meat grinder that run for national office is.
But she seemed to also at least relish it publicly. She seemed to be just basking in all that attention and spotlight.
Right, yeah. Well, hey, you get that much applause from a crowd that's that big, you know, I'd have the same reaction.
Let me see what Suzanne has to say. And Suzanne is joining us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Just talking about what you were just talking about, the movie Game Change, how she was depicted in that movie, she said that was totally false. Do you agree with that, or was there some truth to how she was shown in that movie?
And we should say that the book became an HBO movie, won some
right.
awards
yeah.
at the Golden Globes.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't confess this, but I don't have HBO, so I only know what about Game Change from having read about
it. We'll have to fix that for
yeah,
you.
That's right. But I've certainly heard a lot about it, and you know, any Hollywood production is obviously going to take some liberties with the storyline. But I think if you read the book Game Change, and if you read the book by the book called Sarah from Alaska by Shoshana Walsh and her co-author who covered her during the vice presidential campaign, you'll see that there's a fair amount of truth to the notion that she was high maintenance. She was under a lot of stress. She was close to, you know, cracking under the strain. So, you know, those are verified accounts by real journalists.
You quote an Alaska journalist in this book who had covered Sarah Palin, questioning her honesty. Now, I don't think we should be shocked about a elected official or a politician having their honesty challenged. But what do you think he meant by that? And of course, it can mean just, you know, little lies around the edges, and it can mean something more profound than that.
Right, right. I have a chapter in the book called "The Truth Can Be So Inconvenient," and I think, you know, when she felt trapped, she would try to tell some sort of story to work around the reality that she was being confronted with. For example, when the legislative investigation came back that said probable cause she violated Alaska state ethics law by allowing her husband to try to get her ex-brother-in-law fired, she said, completely cleared there, you know, no evidence of any wrongdoing. And everybody in the national press and anybody who was familiar with the situation, their jaws dropped. They went, what?
That was the exact opposite of what
the report said. Now, what I'm wondering is, had she gotten some advance word about what the other investigation was going to say? Because that was the one that said, you know, yeah, she's okay. She didn't violate the law. You know, Todd did all that stuff on his own, and he's a citizen, and he has his rights to complain, so no violation. And I'm wondering if she got the two mixed up in her mind, but the other one didn't come out until 3 or 4 weeks later, so I'm not sure if that was a mix-up or what was going on. But, you know, my own experience is stress can make you stupid. So even if you're smart and you're under a lot of stress, you can do things that you, in retrospect, regret.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again. Matthew Zenzi is our guest today on Radio Times. Spent a number of years as a journalist with the Anchorage Daily News, working with a editorial page there. And he's the author of a new book called Unlikely Liberal, Sarah Palin's Curious Record as Alaska's Governor. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
On the next Fresh Air, Gene Robinson reflects on his time as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church. He's just retired. For years, Robinson received death threats. One suspect was arrested with photos of Robinson.
He had scrawled across them, "Save the church, kill the bishop," and he had a sawed-off shotgun and tons of ammunition.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Most of us think we know what's going to happen tomorrow. But life is full of random moments, good things and bad, that seem to come out of nowhere. And how we handle them is important to our well-being and personal narrative. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, how life comes at us out of nowhere and how we handle it. Today at noon, here on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Since her run for vice president, Sarah Palin has become the voice of face of conservative politics. She's a regular commentator on Fox News. She's been an ardent supporter of Tea Party candidates, and she's a reliable critic of progressive policies. This is very different from the Sarah Palin who was governor of Alaska and mayor of Wasilla. Our guest, Matthew Zensi, says Alaska, the most socialist state in the country. And again, his book is called Unlikely Liberal. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's see what Chris from Bucks County has to say. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, my question is that you're claiming that Governor Palin used, in effect, state funds or public funds for private use in taking her children with her, et cetera, on trips. And my question is, does not the President of the United States do exactly the same thing? Does not the President of the United States use Air Force One for campaign trips? Does not Nancy Pelosi do the same thing? And many, many other politicians use public funds for private use. And to do an assassination attempt on Governor Palin, I think, is really quite outrageous. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. The political world has is notorious for doing these things. And if everybody was held to accounting, none of this would happen. But that is normal practice.
Well, Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give our guests a chance to weigh in on that. And I don't see our conversation as an assassin, you know, quote unquote assassination attempt on Sarah Palin. But go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, well, I think the caller raises a fair question.
Sure.
What is good public policy when it comes to elected officials and traveling with their families? You know, a good family value policy might be to, you know, to make it easier for the politician to travel with their family. Unfortunately, that's not what the state of the law was in Alaska at the time. And apparently there's some difference between Alaska law and the federal law that your caller alludes to. There was an ethics complaint about this, and Palin did settle it. She did repay $10,000, roughly, plus or minus, in two installments of her kids' travel. And, you know, she did go back and, you know, change some of the forms to make it more likely that, you know, her kids were officially part of business so that they could their travel mm-hmm. could be billed to the state. So, you know, the caller raises a legitimate policy question. Unfortunately, the state of law was different in Alaska at the time.
Now, Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. After the campaign was over, McCain and Palin obviously lost to Obama, President Obama, and Vice President Joe Biden. She goes back to Alaska, and before long, she quits her job. I remember that, and I found that so surprising.
Right, right. I was on vacation in a wilderness national park in Alaska, and the word reached me there at the lodge, and I almost didn't believe it. But then we had another journalist there who had already verified it, and so it's like, okay, I believe it because you checked it out. It was astounding. I figured she wouldn't run for reelection, but to resign just was mind-boggling. But as I mentioned in the book, I think there's probably 8 or 10 different reasons that contributed to it. You know, she felt the hassle factor from all the ethics cases, but most of the bills were for the Troopergate investigation where she filed the complaint against herself and spent a lot of money, mm-hmm. you know, processing that complaint. She had the strains of her family life, the special needs child at home. She had accomplished a lot already, as she said in the email she sent to her ghostwriter, Lynn Vincent, for her book Going Rogue. She was going to have to do things that weren't all that much fun. She had other opportunities to write a book and become famous, and it's easier work. So there were a lot of factors that went into it. There were only two elements that were kicked around at the or two possible explanations kicked around at the time that you could rule out. One was rumors that she and Todd were getting divorced. You know, that didn't pan out. And the second was rumors that there was an FBI investigation of whether she diverted materials to build her house when the sports center was being built in Wasilla when she was mayor. And the FBI actually put out a statement saying, no, we're not investigating that. that, nothing happening, which, you know, the FBI almost never does. So those are the only two reasons you can rule out. I think all the rest, you know, were pebbles or rocks on a scale, and eventually the scale just went, boom, I'm out of here.
As you said, when she was governor, her popularity is, 80-85%. I mean, extremely popular governor. When she came back, what was her popularity?
Well, her popularity was slipping right away. Interestingly enough, the McCain-Palin share of the Alaska vote in 2008 was 2 percentage points lower than Bush and Cheney had obtained in the prior election. Now, part of that was McCain was famous for feuding with Alaska's senior senator, Ted Stevens, over pork and over oil drilling. So there might, but she didn't help him make it back up either. And then as it became more and more clear that she was just not interested in being governor anymore, her popularity sank, and she was below 50 when she resigned. And at one point after she left, only Massachusetts held her in lower regard than Alaska did in popularity ratings.
Let me get, it looks like Jim from Princeton to join our conversation. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I just wanted to remark about McCain, how he basically blamed Palin, that and also the headwind of the election for his own failures, but he's the same candidate who quipped that he didn't know much about the economy, but he was trying to get studied up as quick as possible. This is in the middle of the general election when the economy was going completely off of the cliff. And the other part is, I think that other callers are right, that Palin serves as kind of a stand-in to bash the white working class and middle class and, or lower middle class in this country. And I have to say that as a Democrat, I see it, and it's sad, but that's it. Mm. She's being blamed by McCain for his own failures. He was a terrible candidate, but he doesn't get attacked the way that Palin gets attacked.
Well, it's interesting.
And,
it's a very interesting comment. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. What do you think, Matthew?
Well, certainly Palin's defenders share the caller's perspective. Let me read you one that was put on Huffington Post after I wrote something. This fellow said, he actually signed his name, which is relatively rare. He said, had she run the 2008 campaign instead of the idiots McCain hired, we never would have had the communist devil who sits in the White House now destroying America. So Palin's supporters definitely share your caller's point of view.
Although, I think our caller is a little more subtle than the writer to that Huffington Post article about, and perhaps this gets into the kind of nuance and psychology of campaigning in that particular campaign, which seemed to be kind of a lot of messiness inside the McCain-Palin campaign.
Yeah, there definitely were internal issues there. You know, she wanted to keep campaigning in states that they'd written off and so on and so forth, yeah.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jim, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I mean, would it be fair to say, perhaps this is in John McCain's court, but that Sarah Palin, in a sense, gave rise to a Tea Party movement, which has really moved the Republican Party in many ways to the right?
Well, clearly what McCain's intent was in picking her was to fire up the conservative base because, you know, he was a maverick. He wasn't exactly a Republican team player. He wasn't going for the women's vote. He was trying to fire up the Republican base, and that definitely worked. Now, she was one of the specks around which the crystal of the Tea Party later formed. You know, I'm not sure how much credit to give it to give to her on that, but, you know, the growing presence of immigrants in the country, the economic stress that the middle class is under, all these contribute to the rise of the Tea Party. And, you know, she made sure to, you know, run to be among those at the head of that parade.
What is it like to cover politics in Alaska? As you said, Wasilla, 600 miles from the capital. Does everyone just fly everywhere to get from point A to point B?
Yeah, my son's working in the legislature down there now for this session, and, you know, he's probably not even going to be able to make it home until the session's over because it's so far away. It is up close and personal. You know, politics in Alaska is a contact sport, and it's, you know, it's a small state, and people know each other. I mean, the neighborhood where I lived, there was an ex-governor, an ex-mayor, another ex-governor, and a third ex-governor. it was up close and personal.
So everyone sort of knows everybody else, even though it's a big state, but not a whole lot of people.
Yeah, it's very far flung, and the people that, you know, live out in the smaller communities or way out in what Alaskans would call the bush, you know, usually come through Anchorage anyway. So yeah, you do see people from all over.
But do you see her, and by that I mean Sarah Palin's, I guess, rise and certain kind of fall as a cautionary tale? I mean, is there something we can extrapolate from her unique, perhaps even enigmatic career?
Well, I think it's a commentary on how little the, you know, what those of us who are journalists and other, you know, which she would call lamestream media intellectual elitists would say is the role of reason in politics and political behavior. It is so so detached, really, from, you know, rational arguments about issues. It's all about character. It's about tribal identity. It's about psychological. It's about values. The kinds of things I did as an editorial writer for 21 years and occasionally did at the Philadelphia Inquirer play a very small role in most people's political, you know, most ordinary citizens' political decision making. You know, only a very small percentage of the American electorate reads editorial pages and sort of sifts the arguments that you make. So much of it is really about, you know, which team am
feelings?
I on? Yeah, feelings, emotion, which team am I on? What values do I hold? Who represents my values? And, you know, you'll give people passes on other things if you feel enough sort of solidarity with them about other elements. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more true of conservatives than liberals, if I have 30 more seconds to go on here. It's interesting to contrast Palin's ascension to the national ticket with Chuck Hagel's nomination as defense secretary. You know, she got a pass on all these liberal things that she did. People either didn't pay attention, didn't know about them, or dismissed them. Chuck Hagel is getting blasted from both sides. You know, Republicans consider him a turncoat who's wrong on the issues. The Democrats, or at least some of them, are open-minded enough to say, well, you know, if Obama wants him and, you know, we think he's good on these Democratic issues, approach to defense issues, you know, we'll bring him on board. But then there are many other Democrats and progressives saying, hey, wait a minute, he doesn't get a pass on being anti-abortion, anti-gay. You know, he wouldn't even let female service members, or he wanted a policy where female service members who would pay for their own abortions couldn't get them in military facilities. So they're saying his socially conservative values are indeed relevant to his defense duties, whereas some Democrats are saying, you know, that really all that stuff isn't that important to really the mission that he would accomplish. So he's getting a level of scrutiny and discussion of his past record that Palin really, I don't think, had to undergo.
But do you think, I mean, and tribal is a loaded word, but do you think that tells us something about these two political parties that we have? I mean, some have described the Democrats as a circular firing squad, and others, you know, that Republicans are more, you know, are more rule followers.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I've been reading a book called The Republican Brain by Chris Mooney, which really delves into the psychological bases for how people sort of choose conservative philosophies versus liberal philosophies. And it's true that, you know, conservatives have a much more hierarchical view of the world, more authority-bound, and liberals are more questioners. They're more open to new experience and new information. It's just a psychological truth.
But what's interesting, and again, looking back at Sarah Palin's work in Alaska, she worked bipartisanly.
Absolutely.
I mean, she was a bipartisan politician.
Absolutely. Her most reliable supporters for her big accomplishments were Democrats. I mean, the Republicans were sort of split, not quite 50-50. It depended on the issue. And, of course, her ethics reform passed almost unanimously. But the main opponents of ethics reform before she elected were Republicans. They're the ones that killed it in the legislature. So Democrats, to this day, are defending her oil tax against the efforts of her Republican successor to roll it back.
This may be too big a leap, but as you're describing her and frankly reading your book as well, I was reminded of Ronald Reagan and his supporters and many people that call out his name as an example of conservative politics don't know that he raised taxes, don't know that he opposed assault weapons. And it is interesting, I think all of us have these blind spots about people that we consider to be our political heroes or perhaps leaders.
Oh, absolutely. It's in Chris Mooney in his book mentions that, you know, most people do engage in what's called motivative reasoning, finding the information that will help support your pre-existing view, cognitive dissonance, you know, dismissing information that contradicts your values or your pre-existing views. But he also does point out that because of the sort of the psychological differences that lead you to become a conservative or a liberal, you find more denial of reality, more of that on the conservative side of things. And it sort of depends also on you know, the environment of the time. He points out that, for example, in communist countries, the dynamics are completely different because of the political context. Mm-hmm. But in our context, at least, you find conservatives being more resistant to science, like with global warming, than you do on mm-hmm. the liberal side of things.
Do we still have communist countries? I guess maybe a handful.
Well,
China,
there's one China, which is, you know, killing us in the capitalist marketplace.
Yes, interesting. So has Sarah Palin contacted you about your book about her called Unlikely Liberal?
No, she hasn't. And
would
I'm
you
a
like
little,
her
little
too?
Disappointed. I figured if, you know, she'd like a few chapters of it and definitely would not like the last two-thirds of it. And if she said something about it, it would probably stimulate more discussion. But no word yet.
So what was it like to write this book? A cognitive dissonance for you as well?
Well, no. I was a little offended as an Alaska journalist because when she got nominated, you know, journalists parachuted in from the States, starting from ground zero, and really, you know, didn't know the players, didn't know the issues, didn't know which way the coalitions crosscut. You know, they really had to get up to speed and learn things. And a number of them did a, you know, pretty good job of the little pieces that they were biting off. And I wanted to pull it all together into a coherent whole and tell the story that I think people missed in the lower 48, because she was a very different, pragmatic, bipartisan, not so ideological, liberal policy promoting governor in Alaska, very different from what you saw in the lower 48.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Matthew Zensi, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Happy to do it.
And his book is called Unlikely Liberal, Sarah Palin's Curious Record as Alaska's Governor. And Matthew Zensi now lives down here in the lower 48, as he describes, in the Philadelphia area, spent many years in Alaska and was a journalist with the Anchorage Daily News. Go to whyy.org/radio. Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.